Good afternoon, everyone. Meeting of the Ways and Means Committee will come to order. The clerk will note the roll. There is a quorum. We have the minutes of April 24th before us. Representative Carlson moves approval of the minutes. Any corrections, additions, or changes? Seeing none. All in favor of approving the minutes, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The minutes are approved. Okay, members, we've got Representative Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, maybe this is a question for the end of the meeting, but so I don't forget. It looks like tomorrow is going to be a pretty big and busy day on the House floor, and I was going to ask what your plans were, if you had any thoughts, because the DFL caucus would like to talk about the upcoming bills at some point tomorrow, and we would need to do a little pre-planning. So have you gotten any thoughts together about how you might schedule tomorrow?
Well, Representative Carlson, certainly would be after session. We would huddle and then have ways and means. I guess we'll have to see how late it goes. But we are at this point going to be meeting at 10 a.m. on Friday to take up at least the jobs bill. And so if for some reason we were not able to conclude the other three bills we're planning tomorrow, well, really four, House File 4099, the vehicle bill, and then state government, agriculture, and environment. If for some reason we couldn't complete those, we would meet at 10 a.m. Friday and finish them.
Okay, and then, Mr. Chairman, it sounds like, though, for whatever you take up tomorrow, we'll have a schedule similar to today where there'd be an opportunity to get together and talk about the bills that may come up tomorrow, depending on how quickly you can get through them.
Yes, that would be my plan, Representative Carlson. We want to be able to huddle with our caucus, and I'm sure you do too, and we want to allow time for that.
Thank you.
Okay. Okay. So, members, today our schedule, we're going to do taxes, and then similar to what happened on Monday where we had the higher education bill come up first, we took amendments, then temporarily laid it over and brought up the education bill, and then brought higher ed into education. In this case, after taxes, we'll bring up transportation, temporarily lay it over, then bring up health and human services, and then amend transportation onto health and human services. So that'll be the schedule and the plan for today. And with that, Representative Davids moves the omnibus tax bill, that House File 4385, be referred to the General Register. Representative Davids.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Just to report, we've met our budget targets for this committee. This is the bipartisan conformity bill. And before we get into the actual bill, if we could please get it amended to the shape that the author would prefer.
Okay, we have two amendments. I think the first one we'll take up is the A-28 amendment. Representative Davids moves the A-28 amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. These are some technical fixes, some things we worked on yesterday. This cleans up some of the language that we need to do, and I would stand for questions on this amendment.
Okay. Is there any discussion to the A-28 amendment? Seeing no discussion, the A-28 amendment is adopted. Or wait a minute. Excuse me. Seeing no discussion, all in favor of the A-28 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? More prevails, the A-28 amendment is adopted. Sorry,
Chairman.
Folks, I've been doing too many of them.
Mr. Chairman, you are visionary.
All right. Right. Okay, next we have the DE-2 amendment. And, members, I'm going to call on Fulby Sullivan to make a technical correction to this amendment, because if you note on page 1, line 2, it says, delete everything after the enacting clause, and that would be very inconvenient if we adopted this amendment as is. Put a lot of good work out of the picture. So if I can ask Mr. Sullivan for the proper language in the beginning on this amendment.
Mr. Chair and members, to insert this language in...
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. I just became aware that you only have copies on this.
I assumed I was looking through my papers on the last amendment. I assumed that was housekeeping, the one that we just adopted.
I'm sorry, Representative Carlson, what's that?
Well, the last amendment that was just adopted, I was looking through my papers and I didn't find it, but then I've discovered that none of us apparently have it.
Oh, all right.
It was just adopted. I'm assuming that was housekeeping, but if Chair Davids could let us know whether it was housekeeping or not, as we were searching through. This is rather massive.
Mr. Chairman, Chair Carlson, that's okay, a technical one from House, nonpartisan House Research. To correct some references.
Okay. Yeah, the A28 amendment, Representative Carlson and members, was basically or is behind the bill and the spreadsheet. It should be your very last page. But apparently we do not have the DE2 amendment that I was referencing. So we're going to have committee staff make copies of that, and I think while we're doing that, we'll have Chair Davids present the rest of this bill.
Yeah, I found it now, Mr. Chairman. It appeared that it was part of the bill, so Mr. Chairman, but he did say it was housekeeping, so
yeah,
we're fine with that. Then thank you.
Okay, thank you. Chair Davids.
And Mr. Chairman, if I could talk about the D2 amendment for just give a little background on it very briefly, and then we'll just set it aside and I'll go into other aspects of this fine piece of legislation. The D2 amendment was brought to me by Representative Metsa. And we put it off the side yesterday in taxes because I wasn't sure of a couple of things. We checked them out, and Representative Metsa did some homework, and we found out that this is a good amendment. Anytime I get iron range things, I kind of my brain just turns to mush, and it did it yesterday too, Mr. Chairman. So we did our due diligence on this one, so I'll be explaining more of this when every member has a copy and has a chance to look at it. But this is a courtesy to Representative Metsa, and you will notice in the bill it's a delete everything amendment, so that Metsa, you know. So we'll take care of that. Okay. The House File 4385, as it will be amended, does several very good things. First of all, this was originally the governor's bill, just so we know where we're at, was Governor Dayton's bill. We're using it as the base bill for the bipartisan conformity bill here in the House. And I was very thankful to Governor Dayton in several areas. One is as I first received the bill and was reading it, the first thing that popped out to me was that we go from federal taxable income, we're one of only states that still has operates under the federal taxable income, and we go to the federal adjusted gross income. That was a huge hurdle to overcome that I think will make the tax code much better. So I thank Governor Dayton for that. In this bill, we eliminate the corporate AMT. We have an individual income tax rate reduction. We have a small percentage corporate rate cut. Now, there will be some that will want to play the class warfare games, Mr. Chairman. I'm far beyond that. We have a charge. We have a very, very important task to take care of so we can say woulda, shoulda, coulda, if maybe, but I'm beyond that. We have to get this done. This is not a should we pass a bill or could we pass a bill. This is a must bill. This is a bill that we must pass. So once we get past the political rhetoric, I think we can come together and do some very good things. My first charge was when I saw what President Trump had signed on December 22nd, I first thought, well, let's kind of be fair here. Let's kind of have the business money stay with business, the individual money stay with individuals. And that's what I really tried to do. If we do nothing, there'd be about 900,000 plus returns that would have tax increases. We have brought that down, Mr. Chairman, in this bill to about 148,000 would have small increases, but they'd be increases. I couldn't get down to zero. I tried. About 500,000 be held harmless, about 2.1 million Minnesota taxpayers or returns would have tax decreases with our approach. So I'm very excited to work on this bill. We have some individual income tax rate cuts, and you can't just say that, oh, this favors the rich. Like I said, I want to get beyond that point, but some will still be there. I want to get beyond that point. You have to look at the totality of this bill. Lower income brackets make out like bandits. They're treated very, very well in this bill. So what this bill does, members, is we do, and I have to apologize to business here, we do have businesses subsidizing individual rates. I couldn't really get around that, but sometimes we just have to live with disappointment. And so what this bill does, Mr. Chairman and members, it simplifies the tax code. It's a very, very strong bill for individuals. It helps Minnesota's middle class. It makes the tax code much easier for the department to administer, which is one of my goals. I want to work with the department to make sure that they can administer this code here, the tax code. And I'd be remiss if I didn't give a few. So that's kind of the overview of the bill. And if you look at some of the spreadsheets, you'll see your local projects in there. There's fire hall tax, sales tax exclusions, and actually we put a really, really good. I'm really excited about it. But I did bring two things. I brought, for those that want to live in the past and have negative attitudes towards this tax bill, I brought some Kleenex. And for those that will have tears of joy, I have this box of Kleenex. So I would really like to thank the department, Commissioner Bowerly, Mr. Cummings, Leslie Thompson, for their wonderful, wonderful assistance on this bill. I'll tell you what, Mr. Paul Cummings comes to every tax committee meeting, and we give him the opportunity to testify on every bill, and on every bill he testifies on, he is well-read, he has researched the issue, and he gives the department's position very, very clearly. And that's extremely helpful. And so I thank Mr. Paul Cummings. I thank Commissioner Bowerly. I thank Nonpartisan House Research, Partisan Research, the tax staff in the corner of the Office 585, Mr. Tim Smith. I'd really like to thank, I think one person that really stands out on putting this tax bill together, helping us, with some great ideas, is lead on the tax committee for the Democrats, so Representative Paul Marquardt. Really has done a great job, and I really appreciate that. And, of course, I would be remiss, Mr. Chairman and members, if I didn't thank a very, very important person that helped frame this tax bill, Dr. Stephen Rubis, who has done just a wonderful job, and he is a doctor of taxology. And so we're very, very thrilled that he has been able to benefit this bill. His fingerprints are over. I would say, well, what if we did this? What if we did this? And Dr. Rubis puts it together. And we appreciate that. So, again, members, there will be those that want to use this box. I say let's all use this box because we're going to be doing some great things for Minnesotans. Simplifies the tax code, very strong bill for the Minnesota middle class and for the poor. It does not raise taxes, and we have put a great bill together, and I'm very excited about it. And again, members, let's remember three numbers, 68, 34, and 1. We need 68 votes in the House, 34 in the Senate, and we need to work with one governor to get the bill signed. So that's my task, that's my goal, and Mr. Chairman and members, I stand for questions.
Okay, well, members, I think, thank you, Chair Davis. I think at this point people do have the H4139DE2 amendment, and I'm going to call on our counsel, Mr. Sullivan, to give us the appropriate language on page 1, lines 1 and 2, in terms of where it should go.
Mr. Chair and members, to insert this language in the H4139DE2 amendment into the tax bill, it would go in Article 8, the miscellaneous article. So to make that change on the DE2 amendment on page 1, line 1, delete 4139 and insert 4385, comma, the first engrossment, comma. And then on page 1, delete line 2 and insert page 210 after line 6, insert, colon.
All right. Does that sound acceptable to you, Chair Davids?
Yes, thank you. Just so it doesn't become a delete all. That's my main concern. But this again, is the Metsa bill that he was kind enough to lay over yesterday, and we worked on it the last 24 hours, and I think it's in good shape.
Okay. Well, Representative Davids incorporates those technical changes into his amendment on page 1, lines 1 and 2. Are there any questions or discussion to this amendment? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chair Davids, do we know how much is in the fund that would be distributed this different way? And I know that this isn't yours, but I just didn't know if you knew how much was in the fund.
Well, Chair Davids.
I do not. Maybe we could have.
Commissioner. Mr. Chair and members, Kathy Schill, House Fiscal. I do not have that information for you at this time. There is a request with the Department of Revenue. I can tell you that the Taconite Economic Development Fund in distribution year 2017 had $700,000 in it. And from what I understand with the amendment, it would, if you look on page 3, it would receive 10 cents per ton of any excess balance after the distribution. So there's some math to go on in there, and I can get you that answer soon.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Schill. Any other questions on the amendment? Members okay with adopting the amendment? We'll move to the vote. All in favor of the amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. All right. Members, I'm not aware of any other amendments. I do know that Commissioner Bowerly requested to testify on the bill, and so if the commissioner could come forward. Commissioner Bowerly, welcome to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Thank you, Chair Knobloch, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Cynthia Bowerly. I'm the Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Revenue, and thank you for the opportunity to testify on House File 4385. We shared our comments and concerns with the Tax Committee yesterday, Mr. Chairman, but I also wanted to take an opportunity to address the Ways and Means Committee about the budget-related issues presented in this bill. I first want to thank Chair Davids. He and I were just discussing, we rarely get to sit next to each other in a committee setting. So far, so good, Mr. Chairman.
You even have matching outfits today, it looks like.
it's a tax thing, Mr. Chairman. And there are many areas where this bill does have alignment with the governor's bill, and we do appreciate that. But there are some other areas where we have some concerns. Specifically, this bill does not reflect the fiscal sustainability that Minnesota needs. There are significant concerns about the impact on the state's budget and whether those costs are fully shared in this bill in the first biennium. Because the House File 4385 phases in rate changes for individuals and corporations over time, their full costs appear only in fiscal year 2021, the second year of the next biennium. So what's carried as a cost of $106 million in fiscal 19 for the individual rate changes will cost the state at least $197 million in 21 and going forward. And the rate change for corporations is booked at about $24 million in fiscal 19, and the cost of the provision will actually be about $90 million in 21 and years following. It's our view that if the tax provisions are important enough to be included in the bill, they should be carried with their full costs in the first year so that Minnesotans can understand who is benefited and by how much. This is the kind of transparency that we need in our budgeting process. We also note that the bill prepays about $14 million in local government aid. We anticipate that this is needed to make the second biennium of the bill balance. In addition, the bill would reduce the sales tax based on a federal Supreme Court decision that has not been issued and likely will not be issued until June. The bill attempts to anticipate what the Supreme Court may decide on the Wayfair decision and directs the Commissioner of Revenue to reduce the general sales and legacy sales tax rates by a revenue-neutral amount to reflect increased collections from that decision. We do not know yet what the Supreme Court will decide, and based on analysis of last week's hearing before the Supreme Court, that decision seems even more uncertain than it did before. And we don't know whether the court will clearly overturn Quill, uphold Quill, and leave it to Congress, or create a path in between. Legislation attempting to anticipate what the Supreme Court might do creates a high level of fiscal uncertainty. Next, the bill takes money from the stadium reserve account based on forecasted amounts rather than actual receipts. We should not deplete that fund until we know the actual revenue flowing into the account, and only at that point should we make any changes. As we review the spreadsheet in the bill, we will learn more about the long-term costs of the bill, and we need to consider how they will be balanced against the revenue sources in the bill. For example, the deemed repatriation provision will end after 8 years, but it seems to be built into the revenue stream to fund permanent rate changes. And several provisions, such as the historic rehabilitation tax credit change, actually just shift the year in which the revenue is realized. Mr. Chair, this committee set a target of a little over $107 million to be spent on taxes, and 4385 conforms to that target. I would be remiss, however, if I did not share some perspective on how that money is spent and who benefits. Unfortunately, this bill, like the federal tax bill passed last year, provides more for businesses than individuals in terms of the rate changes that it makes. Although it changes income tax rates for both individuals and corporations, it provides a 0.3 rate cut for the second tier, but a 0.7 rate cut for corporations, meaning corporations will get nearly double the rate cut for individuals. And it does help wealthier families more than middle-income families. When fully phased in, the rate cut will provide those earning $40,000 with a $6 tax cut and those earning $270,000 with a $338 tax cut. And those with income less than $37,000 or $25,000 of single will see no rate reduction at all. The bill does increase the standard deduction, but for many working Minnesotans, the increase of the standard deduction will not make up for the loss of itemized deductions that will translate and will only translate to approximately $65 per family. This is particularly true for many of the 900,000 Minnesotans who rely on itemized deductions to save on their taxes. A number of these cost-saving deductions were reduced or repealed under President Trump and Congressional Republicans' tax bill at the federal level. And unlike the governor's bill, House File 4385 removes many of these from the state tax code. And as the chair has acknowledged, that it is very difficult when you remove these itemized deductions to protect Minnesotans from tax increases. I think today, I want to make sure I use the correct number. I think it's now at about 140,000 individuals who will see those rate increases. And it is just a very difficult thing to protect people against when you remove those itemized deductions that Minnesotans rely upon. In the governor's bill, he took a slightly different approach, expanding the working family credit and creating a new dependent and personal credit for individuals earning less than $140,000 and married tax filers earning less than $280,000 per year. Mr. Chairman, there are just a couple of other provisions in House File 4385 that will affect the state's revenue stream over the long term. One of those is the change to indexing in the bill. The House approach moves the indexing of brackets and various tax credits to change CPI, except for the property tax refund. This means that brackets will increase more slowly, increasing taxes on individuals and increasing state revenue. In addition, because other credits increase more slowly, tax credits and other benefits will be less beneficial over time. These changes may seem technical, but they will have real impacts on Minnesotans by raising their taxes over time compared to what they would pay under current law and increasing the revenue stream to the state. The bill removes funding from the Department of Revenue Service and Recovery Fund. This is the fund that we provide staffing and other support for local governments in helping them administer their local option sales taxes. For example, we recently released a new online sales tax calculator that makes it easier for businesses across the state to have precise information about local and state sales tax rates. The number of local option sales taxes are increasing, and local governments are expecting quicker turnaround times in activating those taxes. Given this increased demand for services, it does not make sense for the legislature to send the opposite message to the department and its customers by reducing our capacity to accommodate local government requests. This is compounded by the nearly $4 million annual cut to the agency's appropriation in the state government bill, which this committee will hear tomorrow. The governor has been very clear about his commitment to fiscal sustainability for the state of Minnesota. His commitment is the reason that he proposed restoring free items in last year's tax bill, the general levy inflator, the cigarette inflator, and freezing the estate tax. As the governor expressed in a letter to legislative leaders on April 9th, the long-term fiscal sustainability of the state is his highest priority. He has worked over the past 7 years to restore the state's fiscal stability and will not support any bill that threatens that stability. We look forward to working with the chairman and the tax committee and this committee as this bill moves forward. There are significant areas of agreement, but we have a great deal more to do if we are to put low-income and working families first in a tax bill that helps family budgets while protecting Minnesota's budget. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for the time.
Thank you, Commissioner. Representative Davids.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Commissioner. One thing that I would just like to update a little bit, Mr. Cummings gave testimony a few days ago about the quill provision we have in there, and he made up some very good points about, he didn't make them up, they're facts. He made some very good points about, well, what happens if it's a partial overturn, or what happens if this happens or that happens. In the amendment, we did address that. In the A28 amendment, we did address that. And the way it reads now, and it will still be up for discussion, it has to be a complete overturn or quill before anything would kick in. But, I mean, it's still up for debate and so forth. But we did, Mr. Cummings brought up a very good point. We did listen, and we did take care of that part of it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All right. Thank you, Chair Davids. Is there any discussion to the bill or questions for the chairman, Representative Carlson?
I've got a question of the commissioner or anyone else that would be prepared. But, Commissioner, you referenced the stadium reserve account, and that was a subpoint when we passed the budget resolution about putting a cap at $25 million, I think, if I recall correctly from the budget resolution. But what's the impact of that cap relative to the bond reserves? It was my understanding when that bill was passed that they had to have that reserve built in to get a favorable bond rating and what have you. And maybe that's a question for MNB. I don't know. But, Commissioner, if you know the answer, otherwise I would like somebody maybe before it's on the floor to give me an answer to that question, because I don't think we want to put the bonding at risk. And there were certain taxes that go into the fund, some corporate taxes and maybe a couple of others. I don't recall exactly what all went into the fund.
Commissioner Bowerly.
Chair Knobloch and Representative Carlson, I will need to defer some of those more detailed questions to MMB as they manage that reserve fund, but I think you're correct to recall that there were a couple of revenue streams that go into that reserve. And, of course, it's always important to make sure that we are maintaining those reserves. And I believe it is also intended to ensure that there's sufficient operating money available for that facility. So I will convey the question to Commissioner Franz and ask him to follow up with the committee.
Mr. Chairman, I think that would be important, and maybe for committee members to know, because, as we all know, that whole stadium issue and how it was funded was a rather touch-and-go issue, and now we're changing with the cap some of what was originally agreed to in the passage of the bill. So I think it would be helpful to know what road we're on relative to what that cap means long term. So thank you.
And Representative Carlson, when we take up the state government finance bill tomorrow, that would be another appropriate time to ask those questions as well. I don't know if Commissioner Franz will be there for that, but I know there's language related to that in the state government finance bill.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, I just wanted to ask you a couple of questions. In your letter that you submitted to state government finance earlier in session, you had discussed the need, the importance, not only for your agencies but individual tax filers, to have conformity and put that in place. And I think Chair Davids has done a good job of meeting that goal. But today, and then Mr. Cummings yesterday in Tax Committee discussed all of these different deductions that you want to have still in place. And that obviously would make filing taxes more complicated instead of simplifying them. And I know in your letter to us, you stated how important that was to do that. So I did take a look at some of the ones that Mr. Cummings listed off yesterday, and I just wanted to see who that would impact. And when I look at the different deductions, you, in essence, what you're doing is these are all deductions that that benefit the higher income earners. One that really sticks out at me is the casualty and theft losses. For that, the top tax bracket, they're at $1.1 million, but they would be getting that back. And you compare that then to those that are earning under $50,000, they're at $43,000. So it's very clear that it would be regressive and that we would be then keeping in place these deductions that are quite regressive and doing the opposite of what Minnesota's general tax policy has been. We've always tried to be a more progressive state. So can you talk to me a little bit why we would want to keep these deductions just from the management side of it being more complicated, but then not only that, just for the fact that these are really regressive. Why would you want to do that?
Commissioner Bowerly.
Chair, Chair Knobloch and Chair Anderson, first with respect to the letter that we sent you, we indicated that Minnesota needed to do something to respond to the federal tax bill. And that's what the governor's bill does. That's what this proposal does. The most difficult situation would be if we do nothing, and then we would have a very disconnected tax code. So like many other states, moving to AGI would allow Minnesota more control, would allow us to have our own personal personal dependent exemptions, all our own itemized deductions. So I think that there are many states who do that and continue to have itemized deductions available for their taxpayers. With respect to specific provisions, certainly in the list of 40, there are some that benefit different types of taxpayers. I think there's one that covers investment-related fees. Obviously, you have to invent funds to be able to have an investment account like that to have the fees. There are others that cover unreimbursed employee expenses. And there's over 100,000 Minnesotans who claim that deduction each year, and I think they average about $450 in that deduction. And so those could be construction workers who have to drive from job site to job site. So there are a lot of working families in Minnesota who claim those deductions, and that's what the governor's bill was preserving.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, I've even looked at the other category of all the other miscellaneous deductions, and it's $2 billion on the top level, top earners, $2 billion that they would be getting in these deductions in comparison to $110 million to those in the lowest income category. So, I mean, that's a lot. So in every category that I'm looking at, there is not a single situation where the top income earners, they're making out like bandits, whereas the low income earners are the ones that are not. So it is really regressive, and I'm just surprised, you know, given the comments and just our general tax policy in the state of Minnesota. So I'd like to have more conversation with you about that. I'm a little concerned that we would go that route and have a more regressive tax system.
Commissioner Bowerly.
Chair Knobloch and Chair Anderson, the governor's package as a whole is extremely progressive. As I think those of you who follow the analysis that goes along with progressivity, regressivity, or tax system, that scores usually a negative one to a positive one. The governor's bill is a two, a positive two. And so the governor is very concerned about ensuring that our tax code is progressive. The governor is very concerned about ensuring that working families across Minnesota whose wages may not have been increased over the last decade have the ability to claim more in their taxes. And that's why he's proposed the personal dependent credit, which will save a family of four $240 on their taxes and will provide a tax cut for over 1.9 million families. And he's proposed expanding the working family credit, which helps is an important anti-poverty tool that's in our tax code, and we'll expand that for over 300,000 families with an additional credit available for those with larger families, for families with three or more children.
Other questions? Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Commissioner. Thank you for being here. My apologies for not catching your testimony yesterday on taxes. But one of the things that Chairman Davids has done in this bill is obviously he's positioned it for compromise. Some of my caucus may say he's compromised too much. Would you concede that his inclusion of the repatriation money, the deemed repatriation money, that's a significant movement towards the governor and a significant step towards compromise? Would you dispute that?
Commissioner Bowerly.
Chair Knobloch and Chair Garofalo, I think that certainly the inclusion of some of the foreign income that is captured under the federal bill is a recognition of that revenue that should be coming to Minnesota. Of course, the governor treats it in a very different way. I think it's about a third of the revenue that is proposed in the governor's bill for just that item. And then, of course, there's the global intangible low tax income and the foreign-derived intangible income that is that was covered at the federal level, and the governor is proposing full conformity for all three of those types of foreign income.
And Representative Rockwell, right, Mr. Chairman and Commissioner, but obviously the deemed repatriation, having state income tax collections on dollars that are not in the United States of America or in the state of Minnesota, this is a pretty edgy position that we're taking. And I'm seeing Chairman David's move towards the administration, focusing on the importance of getting this bill done, and I'm seeing him getting pistol-whipped in front of the committee today. And I'm kind of, I have to tell you, I'm a little bit surprised. I was feeling really good yesterday about the positive comments and where things were going. He's making significant concessions, and the book on this administration, candidly, is they don't know how to negotiate a bill. And what happens is when we move towards you guys, you back away, and you end up having a bill that's going to get written by the House and Senate and legislators of both parties, with the administration being bystanders. And we've seen this over the last 7 years, and we're starting to see it again. Commissioner, would you at least concede that Representative David's bill, that it does shift tax burden, it shifts tax relief from businesses to individuals, so that we're actually taking the revenue raisers that are on the business side and giving them to individuals for tax relief, another controversial provision in our caucus?
Commissioner Bowerly.
Chair Knobloch and Chair Garofalo, I'm afraid I haven't studied this spreadsheet enough closely. I don't have any reason to think that that's not the case given the top line numbers, but I simply I'm not deep enough in this bill to be able to agree with you on that particular point.
And Mr. Chairman, Representative Garofalo,
thanks, Greg. And Mr. Chairman, all three Mr. Chairman, we appreciate that there are significant areas of overlap in these bills. The governor's proposed full 179 expensing, this bill does the same. There are significant areas of overlap where this bill conforms to federal law as the governor's does. So I think there is lots of overlap here. There is still significant work to do in terms of some of the larger policy issues about where the priorities for this bill need to be in order for it to win the governor's approval. So the governor has put out his position, and we appreciate the bill that's been put out. I think given that this bill is necessitated by what happened at the federal level, where 40% of the net cost of the bill went to corporations with a significant rate cut, I think that is an element of the context of this conversation as well.
Representative Hornstein.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And I, you know, my question and concern is somewhat actually similar to Representative Garofalo's, but maybe from a different perspective. I do applaud you, Chair Davis, and we've talked about the deemed repatriation. And you have $50 million of one-time money, but there's potentially $160 million there. And this should be a no-brainer, members. I mean, this is money that corporations have been hiding for many, many years in overseas tax havens that, under the federal bill, we conform to it, we get all of that money. And I can see, you know, everybody around this table, bipartisanly, I think, would appreciate $110 million more dollars in the general fund. And so I do appreciate that there's some money here. I think it's I'm very troubled by the fact that this was done under threat of lawsuit. And this should be a bipartisan, clear priority to get all of that money back. Again, it's been sitting there untaxed in overseas tax havens. While hardworking Minnesotans are paying their taxes, we have these large corporations that have been hiding it overseas. And I think while this is I appreciate your work on this, Representative Davis, but I think we can do better on it.
Chair Davis.
Well, thank you, Representative Hornstein. It's not just large corporations that have money hidden overseas. There's others of us, so it's not just large corporations, I'm trying to say. And again, when we keep talking about the federal bill, I can't control the federal bill. I'm trying to do the very best I can with what I have. As far as GILTI and FITI, Chief Justice Greg David says those are clearly unconstitutional if we go after that. I really believe that. And think about this for a second. One reason I wanted to go with your bill that went all the way on deemed repatriated. I love that. I wanted to go after that. After more research and study, I thought, oh, boy, we could lose on that one, too. So I went with the net amount because if we lose in court, we got to find $50 million. I can find $50 million quicker than I can find $160 million. So I tried to find some place in the middle there where we could possibly cut our losses. If that happens, I hope it doesn't happen. I mean, I would hope that the business community would say, hey, this is a good bill. I mean, Section 179, corporate AMT, gone. I just go down the list. Corporate rate cuts. If they want to sue over that, then I guess I get sued all the time. They'll just have to do that.
Representative Hornstein.
Well, thank you. And exactly, Chair Davids. I mean, they're getting a lot of goodies here. And so, you know, something like this, which I think is clear, there shouldn't be threats of lawsuits. And I think we should be getting, as you point out, you know, the maximum we can get. Because this is, again, something that I think is just an issue of fairness, if nothing else. So, again, I do appreciate your work, but I think we can do better.
Well, and sure, Mr. Chairman, to Representative Hornstein, we need to be clear that the business community is subsidizing individuals in this bill. And that's very clear by quite a bit. So, you know, I know we'll hear on the House floor, big corporations are evil and should be destroyed, and we have to do all these things. I understand that. But we also have to look at the facts. And the facts are is that we have businesses subsidizing individuals here. I tried to keep it as close as I could, but we're a little off on it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
To your favor, Mr. Hornstein, Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Other discussion to the bill. Representative Markworth.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Chair Davids, for your generous comments, and thank you, Commissioner Bowerly, for your hard work and the governor's hard work. And I'm encouraged, even though some of the discussion, I'm encouraged with what I see, because both of the bills there, as Chair David said, we need to pass something. We absolutely need to pass something this year, and Governor Dayton has had a very good faith effort and bill, and now we have Chair Davids with one. And without repeating some of the other things that were mentioned, my only concern in all of this, the main concern, is the focus. Where's the focus going to be? And I know folks on the tax committee has heard this, but we do have to go back to the federal tax bill, because the federal tax bill, certainly the top priority were corporations. They had the 40% rate, permanent cut. And I think that's going to be beneficial. But the fact of the matter is that was the priority. And when it came to working families and senior citizens, when you look at the Joint Committee on Taxation, while there are benefits initially for working families and senior citizens, they begin to disappear quite rapidly under the federal tax bill, under the federal taxes. And, you know, those, if you're making $30,000 or less by 2021, that group is seeing a tax increase under the federal bill. And by 2025, if you're making $40,000 or less, you're seeing an increase. And by 2027, households under $75,000 are seeing tax increases. And those, you know, their benefits are temporary. So I understand we can't control what happens on the federal level. I think it really bothers me that we would let the federal government raise taxes on Minnesota families or senior citizens. And we have to do whatever we can to protect that. So I do think there needs to be a more targeted and direct approach for working families and our senior citizens. And I do think the working family credit, the $60 dependent credit in the governor's plan does a better job than an overall kind of rate cut on the second tier. But I don't think it's that far apart. And there are so many good things in both of these bills. Section 179, full expensing, Chair Davids, Commissioner, that is huge for farmers and small businesses. That's in there. The fact that we're going to the federal adjusted gross income, we've agreed to basically separate from the feds and keep our personal exemptions and dependent exemptions, that's great. I mean, this is so, you know, there's some difference on where the targeting can go. But I think we're going to get a tax bill, Mr. Chair. And I want to thank Chair Davids and Commissioner Bowerly and the governor from everything I have seen is they're coming, you know, it's moving to the, where we can get this tax bill. And I just think that's real encouraging. And there's work to be done, certainly. But I think it's moving in the right direction. So thank you.
Chair Davids.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, members. I really appreciate your support on 4385 as amended. I must confess I like my bill better than the governor's, but we are close. We are close. We have so many similarities. And I really think two things. First of all, to wrap it up, Mr. Chairman, members, I don't think there's anything that Commissioner Bowerly, Senator Chamberlain, myself can't figure out over a good cup of Maxwell House coffee because it's good to the last drop. And so I think I've got it ready to go in my office, and so we should be good there. The other thing is, this pen is the pen that I'm going to set aside that the governor can sign this tax bill with. He uses those cheap Sharpies, you know. I think this is the pen. This is a cross that costs more than my first car. So I'm going to put this off to the side next to my Governor Dayton pens. You know where they are. Because he's going to sign this bill with this beautiful cross pen. So with that, Mr. Chair, members, I'd really appreciate your support, and I look forward to working with Commissioner Bauer in the governor's office. This is not a bill, members. This is an adventure. Let's continue the adventure. Thank you.
With that, Chair Davids renews his motion that House Bill 4385 as amended be referred to the General Register. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. House Bill 4385, as amended, is referred to the General Register.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members.
Thank you.
We'll get it back.
Next up, we have the Omnibus Transportation Bill. We'll take a minute here to let the crowd thin out if you're leaving, but please be quiet while you are leaving if you can so we can quickly get on to the next bill. All right. Chair Torkelson moves that House File 4160 be referred to the General Register. The Transportation Bill. Chair Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm very happy to move House File 4160. I believe it's going to be laid over for a little while. Much to my chagrin, Mr. Chair, you know, for the transportation bill to become included as a vehicle, the vehicle being the House Health and Human Services bill, seems unusual, Mr. Chair. You know, it just seems that transportation should be a vehicle. I'm still wrestling with this issue, Mr. Chair.
Well, I know, Representative Torkelson, that we've had some discussion about it, but on the other hand, your bill has got a lot more money in its target this time than the Health and Human Services vehicle bill, and so I just felt that we had to give Representative Dean some consideration.
So I'm getting a ride in a cheap vehicle, is that it, Mr. Chair?
I know you're a very frugal man, Representative Parkinson.
Thank you. I do appreciate that compliment, Mr. Chair.
Representative Carlson.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, you raise an interesting question. When this bill gets to conference committee, how much movement back and forth will there be with the dollars?
Oh, you're talking about dollars, not vehicles. In
well, we can the movement between the vehicles, yes.
Well, that will be a matter of discussion, Representative Carlson.
So maybe Representative Farkelson is at risk.
There were, I'm sure, will be much more discussion on this subject to come.
You know, Mr. Chairman, you often go where the money is, so.
This could go on for a while. Representative Torkelson.
I may regret ever having started talking about vehicles, Mr. Chair. House File 4160, really, in my mind, is a promises made, promises kept bill. You know, those who remember the end of last year's session, the transportation bill was reduced significantly to get the other bills to balance, and I thank the chair and leadership for responding this year by replacing those funds and giving us a substantial target that we intend to spend in a way that improves the transportation system for the state of Minnesota. I don't know, Mr. Chair, if you'd like to take up the amendments to get the bill in the shape I'd like.
Why don't we do that? First, we'll take a one-word amendment, the A18-0832 amendment. Representative Torkelson moves that amendment. Representative Torkelson.
Thank you. This is just a one-word change in the provision of the bill as requested by the administration.
Discussion to the amendment. See no discussion. All in favor of the A18-0832 amendment being adopted, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. The A18-0832 amendment is adopted. Representative Torkelson moves the H4160A28 amendment. Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I should probably step through these provisions because some of them are brand new. Were not heard in committee, and others are adjustments to the bill. The first provision in the bill increases the funding available for the Rochester Airport project that will update the lighting system there, adding another $1 million from the airport's fund to help that project move forward. The second provision has to do with the small cities allocation. There's been quite a bit of talk recently about the possibility of a constitutional amendment. If that constitutional amendment should go into effect, it would there's a provision in there that would directly affect the small cities base, and so this language would adjust that base should a constitutional amendment be passed. Next, we have some mechanical language that adjusts the Driver and Vehicle Services Fund. That language came at the request of the administration. We're moving a couple of sections of the bill that we felt we didn't really want in there at this time. One dealing with Chapter 171 and another dealing with a CTIP issue. And then, Mr. Chair, we have some language that will permit the department to actually lease airplanes instead of purchasing them through the state budget. We think that's an appropriate way to go about that. You know, the department buys a lot of equipment of various types, and it seems like the planes are the only ones that get this extra attention, making it very challenging to do those replacements in a timely fashion. We feel this change would make the department, give the department the flexibility it needs to keep those planes up to date without forcing them to come to the legislature for those substantial one-time spending amounts. And finally, the last provision in the amendment, Mr. Chair, is one to remove caps on salaries at the airport for the MAC. Apparently, we're in a situation where we're unable to compete for quality people because of the caps that are in place. So this provision removes those caps. So that covers the amendment, Mr. Chair.
Discussion of the A28 amendment. See no discussion. All in favor of the A28 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The A28 amendment is adopted. I know that we have at least one individual, Commissioner Dolman, that I believe wished to testify. Commissioner Dolman from the Department of Public Safety, are you here? Oh, if you could come forward. Commissioner Dolman, welcome back to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Thank you very much, and thank you, members.
And thank you, Chair Torkelson. I appreciate the opportunity to testify on House File 4160. For the record, my name is Mona Doman, the Commissioner of the Department of Public Safety. The focus of this session for DPS has been on the continued improvement of the MNLARS system, support of the deputy registrars who experienced losses during the rollout of MNLARS, and an investment in our public information system, commonly referred to as the PIC, to ensure that all Minnesotans, business partners, and stakeholders can get the assistance that they need when they reach out to the department related to motor vehicle and driver license issues. I would urge all of you to reconsider and fully fund the governor's supplemental budget proposal to support the ongoing improvements to the MNLARS system, the long-term stability of the system, and the investment needed for the PIC. While all of you have heard about the needs facing MNLARS, I want to just spend a moment briefly talking about the needs facing the Driver and Vehicle Services Public Information Center. Currently, there are 43 employees answering calls and emails that come into the Driver and Vehicle Services, whether it be from the public, law enforcement, deputy registrars, dealers, commercial drivers, other state agencies, insurance companies, banking institutions, elected officials, or other states. Before the rollout of MNLARS, there was approximately 227,000 calls a month coming into the PIP. However, less than half of those calls were answered, which is right around 40%. The number of calls jumped after the MNLARS rollout in July of 2017, which made the response rate even worse. When the individuals could not get through on the phone line, they turned to email, where responses sometimes take weeks. This is not acceptable to the governor, nor is it to me. The governor's supplemental budget includes a proposal for an additional 63 full-time staff for the PIC. This number is based on pre-MNLARS call volume using a standard industry call center calculation to provide nearly a 100% call answer rate, and that calculation is called the Erlang C calculation. We have heard from Minnesotans, and I know you have too, about their frustration with not being able to get the assistance they need when they call or email. This is a timely request as we plan for the influx of questions and inquiries related to the launch of the new driver license system and Real ID cards in October. In addition, members and Mr. Chair remain concerned about the financial impact of so many policy provisions that rely on funding from DDS special revenue accounts moving through this legislative process this session. These accounts are based on a fee generated by driver license and motor vehicle transactions. The cumulative impact of all policy provisions being considered may jeopardize the ability for DVS to pay our obligations in the future. For example, yesterday in House Public Safety Omnibus, in the House Public Safety Omnibus Bill, funds to implement proposed ignition interlock changes are being used from these accounts. I ask that impact be considered and any policy provisions, particularly with fiscal impacts, be revisited and agreed to by the established stakeholder process. I and the department remain committed to working with stakeholders, business partners, and you during this transition from the mainframe to today's new technology in providing driver and vehicle services to Minnesotans now and into the future. Thank you for your reconsideration of the governor's supplemental budget proposal.
Thank you, Commissioner Doman. Questions for Commissioner Doman? All right. Thank you, Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We also have Commissioner Clyborne that I understand wished to testify. Commissioner Clyborne, welcome back to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. For the record, my name is Joanna Clyborne. I am the Commissioner of Minnesota Information Technology Services. I want to thank you for the opportunity to testify in House File 4160. But I'm here not just to express my concerns regarding what is in the bill, but rather what is not in this bill. Specifically, there is no funding in the bill for continued development and improvement of the MNLARS system. Absent any additional funding for the current biennium, we will not have the dollars available to address many of the bugs and fixes and new features that the deputy registrars and other stakeholders are calling for in the MNLARS system. We estimate that of the 32 high-priority fixes that have been identified and prioritized by stakeholders, We will only be able to implement 5 to 8 of them using the resources that we currently have available. Let me be clear. This means that no deputy register doing the usability design improvements and no MNLAR systems performance improvements will occur. With only the funding that we currently have available, we would need to ramp down the MNLAR's contractor team shortly into fiscal year 2019, similar to what I had to do previously and the impact it has had in continued development. This ramp down would enable current funds to support a skeleton crew that could support the current system for the remainder of the biennium. However, these existing funds would not permit new system development capabilities. We would operate in a lights-on mode only. With the staff focused on ongoing maintenance and support work that is necessary to ensure things like overnight jobs are run and the system is up and available each day. You have heard time and time again the frustrations of deputy registrars and other MNLAR systems users. We are working hard and as quickly as possible to make systems improvements and enhancements that will reduce stakeholder frustrations. In fact, just this weekend, we had a full test that went very well with several deputy registrars in their office running 1.11.2 and had very positive results and feedback. But the reality of our current situation dictates that if the ramp up currently underway will have to be turned back again if no additional funding is provided. It is the only responsible option to ensure that the system remains available and functional until a future legislature can make the actions needed to ensure the funding and additional development and support improvement. In addition, I want to make it clear that without the additional funding for the MNLAR's improvement and development, it will not be possible to comply with the policy provisions of the bill that require the changes that are being requested to the MNLAR system. I urge you to reconsider this bill. Thank you for your opportunity to testify and express my concerns. I am happy to answer any questions that the committee may have.
Thank you, Commissioner. Questions for Commissioner Clyborne? Seeing no questions, thank you again, Commissioner Clyborne. Okay, members, again, what we're going to be doing is, in a moment here, temporarily laying over House File 4160 as amended to then go to the Health and Human Services Bill. But is there any discussion at this time to House Call 4160, Representative Hornstein.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I just have a couple of comments about the bill that I'd like to share. And I think the commissioners were absolutely correct. You know, it's really what's not in this bill that concerns me. And I think these points that we just heard about MNLARs in particular are important. The legislature has done good work in terms of developing a oversight in the future. It's not the Ways and Means Committee, but we do have a committee now set up, and we have some very specific directives for that committee. And so I think that was an important accomplishment as we respond to the issues with MNLARs. But we're starting to turn a corner. We have a tremendous new Minute Commissioner, Commissioner Clyburn, who you just heard from. And this call center is very important, Mr. Chairman and members, because it's often the first point of contact between our commissioners and the state when they're trying to resolve issues or problems with vehicle registration. And so to not fund it and to have the funding run out in summer, we're just going to go back to more problems, long wait times. There's nothing more frustrating than waiting on hold, whether you're trying to change an airline reservation or whatever it is. There's no more frustrating experience than having to wait on hold. And now we have this call center significantly understaffed. You heard some of the problems with it. So I would really urge that we fund this call center and make some of these funding changes so that we can continue to make progress. We have a new commissioner. We're turning the corner. We're making progress. We can't go back. And I worry that with what's not in this bill, we will go back on the progress that we've made and the corner that we've turned on MNLARs. Secondly, again, we don't have money for public transportation in greater Minnesota and in the metro area except for one very heavily subsidized route from the Mall of America to Shakopee. That's, I think, something like $18 per passenger subsidized route. And so I think the fact that we really have ignored this important mode continues a pattern that I find very troubling. We've zeroed out Metro Transit in the next biennium. We've zeroed them out when there's some available funding to help, which is arguably even the most efficient transit system we have in the state in Metro Transit. And finally, we have some earmarks in this bill. I have no issue with the study for additional lane on 94 and then the Rice County project, but it's funded with trunk highway dollars. And that is, I think, in the context of this bill, perhaps more appropriately done with general fund dollars. A couple of years ago, Mr. Chair, on a bipartisan basis, past transportation finance chairs, Representative Leader, Representative Holberg, Representative Beard, myself, Senator Ingebrigtsen, all warned then Senate Majority Leader Bach and Speaker Dowd the problems with earmarks, because this makes a system that should be done objectively and with established criteria a political system. And we have really gone away from earmarks in our state and nationally. We have a couple earmarks in this bill. I don't think that's responsible or wise. So there's other provisions I think are good. There's a few others that I think are problematic. But it's really the fact that we're not funding MNLARS, we're not funding public transit. I like the fact that we have an effort to get the North Star to St. Cloud. But, again, I think there's another approach here that's a little bit wiser, which is the governor put – he has $850,000 for a study. Here we have some relying on negotiations with railroads, which I'm not as optimistic, Mr. Chair, as you are, that will bear fruit or be free of charge. So with that, those are my concerns, Mr. Chair, and I do appreciate the hard work that you've done, Chair Torkelson, on this. You've run the committee, I think, in a fair and bipartisan way. But this bill does, I think, fall short of what Minnesota needs.
Chair Torkelson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Hornstein, for your comments. We do have a good committee, and I do appreciate the input from Representative Hornstein and the other minority members on the committee. I do feel we have a good bill here, Mr. Chair. You know, I just probably should say something about MNLARS. This has been a tremendously difficult issue. We are now 9 months past the date when we were told last year that MNLARS would be up and running without the need for further investment. We've already invested an additional $10 million in the project, and at this point I'm waiting for the proof that we can do this here in the state of Minnesota with Minute. I'm developing some confidence, not quite as confident as Representative Hornstein is at this point, but we will be taking a look at this as we move through the rest of the session. In the meantime, we have a good bill here, Mr. Chair, that funds a number of projects around the state, puts in more money into corridors of commerce, a very successful program for the state of Minnesota in getting new roads built, put some cash where we need it, and does a lot for the transportation in the state of Minnesota, and I'm proud to bring this bill to the committee.
Well, thank you, Chair Torkelson. Members, at this time, as I previously announced, we're going to temporarily lay over House File 4160 as amended. And now we'll go to the Health and Human Services Bill. Chairdean moves that House File 3138 be referred to the General Register. And Chairdean, folks, if we could have a little bit of quiet here while we're leaving, if you're not interested in staying for this bill. Chairdean, do you want to describe the bill or do you want to go to the amendments first?
Well, I'll just describe, Mr. Chair and members, just the basics of where the large portions of the investment in the bill are, which is there's basically three areas where we're spending additional money. that we're focusing on three priorities within Health and Human Services, both at DHS and Department of Health. One is within elder abuse and reacting to some of the necessary changes that we need to do there emergently, also within opioids. And third and finally, DWRS, which for members who are not in Health and Human Services Committee would be members if you're receiving emails from constituents with the subject line 7% for people who are receiving hourly wages to deliver care in home and community-based settings. That is where we have voted for, appropriated, and carried in our budget money to go to some of these very hardworking people. Unfortunately, through federal change this year, that money was taken out of our forecast. And so actually the money that should be in our forecast was taken out and artificially inflated our surplus. So what we're doing is spending the money that we have for our target, which is $10 million, on replacing that 7%. And or so I thought, and we've discovered through the Department of Health and Human Services as well as MMB that that's actually going to cost more, and so that will be addressed with one of the amendments that we will be taking up to try to fix that. And Mr. Chair, we are not asking for an adjustment to the target in order to reach that. We are finding that within that amendment. And also achieving some other spending within the bill outside of that, but that does reach our budget of $10 million, and that is our target, and we meet our target within the bill. And so with that, Mr. Chair and members, we can take up the amendments and then questions to the bill.
All right, Chairdeen, why don't we take up that A56 amendment first that deals with the DWRS question that you mentioned. Rep. Chairdeen moves the A56 amendment. Chairdeen.
The A56, again, goes tries to find additional funds to match what MMB and DHS are telling us that we need for this money. It directs a rate increase is from an $8.8 million transfer from the DHS IT systems operation account into the general fund. DHS has spent over $40 million on integrated service delivery programs over the last 5 years and has actually no timeline on rolling out this new IT program for eligibility. I think it's an appropriate use for this, and I would ask members for your support on the A56 amendment to help us out with the 7%.
Discussion to the A56 amendment. Any discussion? Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I understand that, you know, if we have to do something to get some money to the fix that, you know, the 7% problem, we have to do that, but I think I just heard Representative Dean say that the money in the amendment comes out of a DHS IT fund, and that being the case, I think it would probably be a good idea to have somebody from DHS come and tell us what that does, and I have no idea what's in that fund, and that could be a pretty significant thing. So could we have somebody from DHS come and give us some explanation?
We can. Yeah, we had planned on having testimony later, but we can bring forward Commissioner Johnson.
Or, Mr. Chair, if it makes more sense for the committee, we could discuss this. But I guess I would like to hear from him now because I don't, you know, I just thought, I don't know how to vote on this amendment. So.
Sure, yeah. No, the amendment's before us. Yeah. I think it's an appropriate time if you've got questions for him to have him come forward. Commissioner Johnson, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chuck Johnson. I serve as Acting Commissioner at the Department of Human Services. This is money from the DHS Systems Fund that supports our IT operations and our IT development within the agency. And that fund has a balance in it, which I believe is where this money is coming from. Those balances are used really to provide us with a way to manage across complicated projects across multiple years. And so we have a balance to help us with unexpected costs. We have a balance to help us also where we have cash flow issues when we're managing a lot of federal dollars that flow through this fund as well. So we believe it's prudent to have that balance, and that's why we maintain it. And we spend over $300 million on IT in a year. Having an $8 million balance seems like a worthwhile thing from us from a fiscal management standpoint. And without it, we would have to either not have a balance or manage down our total IT spend, meaning we would do less project work, be able to make less progress on making our systems work better.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, I heard this somewhere. Is it true that DHS has over 200 open IT positions?
Commissioner Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, I'm not sure the number of open IT positions we have. That's a question probably for a minute, not for me.
Commissioner.
Representative Anderson.
Am I in the ballpark?
Mr. Chair and Representative Anderson, I don't really know for sure. I know we've been staffing up on a couple of projects, so depending on what numbers you're looking at, we may not have hired into the full complement for some of those projects. I would guess it's over 100. I don't know if it's 200.
Representative Anderson.
Mr. Chair and Commissioner, is this fund a result in part from salary savings of having those 200 and some openings?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, I don't believe so. We build a certain amount of expected underspending within how we project what we're going to spend out of the fund. This balance is held and carried particularly for the purpose of using for any emergencies that come up during the year or to manage if there's any downside risk at the end of a year in terms of having spent more than we thought we were going to.
Representative
Mr. Chair, Commissioner, so for the 200 and some open positions that you have, are those savings that you're able to realize or are those savings that Minute gets to realize because they don't have those positions filled?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair and Representative Anderson, we would realize those savings because we provide those funds to Minute to provide services to us.
Representative Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, I got a question either of you or maybe Mr. Marks, but if I recall, when we passed the budget resolution, didn't we set aside in the targets money for the restitution or whatever you call it of the waiver?
You know, I can give a little bit of guidance on that, and I guess then I maybe would have Chair Dean answer it. You know, Representative Carlson, the original estimate we had for this was $10 million. Well, I guess what I should say is that the state, as I understand it, saved $10 million in the forecast by this not happening. And so we booked $10 million. As we got into it more, this is actually a program with matching funds where there's a 50% federal match. And there was, at the time we set the target, some unknowns as to how quickly we could get the federal match reinstituted and some other issues related to just exactly how much this would cost. And so we didn't really know exactly, I think, at the time, what it would cost, but $10 million was our best estimate. That's what was taken out of the forecast, and so we used that as a target. As we got into it further, we found out that there were going to be some additional costs based on how quickly we could start getting the federal match, and that impacted what the overall cost would be. And I guess, I don't know, Charity, if you have anything to add to that, but I think that at least is my layman's explanation of the situation.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Carlson, I think Representative Knobloch states it pretty clearly. That was originally what we thought the hole was at $10 million. And since then, working through MMB and DHS, we found out that it's going to cost them more. We believe that this is the best numbers that we have to cover that so that people won't start seeing a cut on July 1st. We're trying to fill that hole between July 1st and January 1st in the 19 fiscal year.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I think everybody wanted to fill that hole. I was just curious as to what was happening, being that I remember you made the point rather strongly that when you went through the budget resolution initially that we were covering the backfill, I guess is the best way to put it, for the disability waiver. So that explains it then. It was more expensive than the $10 million, so we're still covering the full cost. So what is the full cost then with the amendment? And then I'm assuming you're using the full $10 million, Representative Dean? So
it's yeah,
$10 million sure, plus what is in the amendment.
Yeah, that it captures $8.8 million on top of the 10 to make that whole. And what that is from my understanding, is that we're actually going to be having to pay both sides of that amount for that amount of time, and that we won't have a and we also will take that all the way through January, so we won't have a cliff some months before that. So we're trying to do the best we can to make sure that there's not a cut.
Well, the reason I was asking, Mr. Chairman, none of the $10 million is being diverted then. It's the $10 million plus the amendment, which is roughly $8 million to cover the backfill. I think that explains it then. Thank you.
Yes. Other discussion of the A56 amendment. Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I hope that fiscal staff will kind of, I know the spreadsheet's based on the bill without the amendment, so
yeah.
I'd like to see what it will be afterwards. But Representative Dean, just, and I just want to say, I know this is a really complicated issue, and we all want to solve it, and we've all been struggling with it, and I appreciate your efforts to do that. But my question, this solution that's in the amendment is a new one. And so the question I have is, this is based, as I understand it, on the need to get a new waiver from CMS to continue on after the end of this year. And the money that's being designated in the amendment is for between July 1st of this year and December 31st. Mm-hmm. What if CMS approves the waiver earlier, or what if it doesn't get, what if we don't get the approval by the end of the year? Does the amendment, does the language here give us flexibility so we don't overpay or run out of money and then, you know, there's a cliff for these services? Then, you know, I mean, how is that all going to work?
A chair team.
Mr. Chair and Representative Liebling, that was one of our concerns, was that we don't see we don't put people in harm's way between now and January 1st, so that we have a continuity of payments that we can cover within this cost. It's significantly more than we had originally anticipated, but in working with MMB, we're trying to make sure that we can cover both sides. And so that we don't short people so that we cover all of it to January 1st. And we could have somebody from MMB talk about the approval process and about retroactively what would happen to those funds. That was our intent in working with MMB, and that's what's reflected in the A56.
So, Mr. Chair,
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Dean, I understood that you're trying to cover the shortfall for folks out of state-only funds, you know, while we don't have that match because it was disapproved, and hoping to kind of get things back on track. But I'm just, you know, we've got a very specific time period here for the money. So if CMS comes through for us in October, does the money then, what happens to the leftover funds? Or conversely, if CMS comes through for us in, God help us, you know, that they do, but in February, say, we're leaving a gap there. Well, I guess we'll be back in session, but nevertheless, you know, there could be either, you've got a very specific time frame here, and we don't know whether CMS is going to come in quicker and help us out, or wait longer and say what you presented doesn't even work for us.
Yeah.
Chair Dean.
And Mr. Chair and Representative Liebling, we've anticipated from MMB, frustratingly so, the most conservative reading we have of the situation and paying both sides. And if we were to receive earlier approval, let's say October, to receive that back from CMS, MMB would have to be able to tell you how we would handle the additional funds in between that time period. And perhaps someone is here from MMB who could tell you how to do that. But I can just tell you from the frustrating conversations that we've had with MMB, they have very conservatively viewed the fiscal side and kind of pushing us to come back again to the committee and look for more money to cover the most conservative reading of this.
Okay. And
Representative Luling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Chair Dean. And, you know, I really do appreciate the problem that you're in, that you're trying to solve. And I am a little bit concerned about how the amendment tries to solve the problem. Mr. Chair, we have money that's going into the reserves. I mean, I realize Chair Dean has this target that he's been given to deal with, and he's had to figure out a way to do it. It seems to me that this would be an area where it would be make sense to have an amendment to his target because, you know, I from what I understand from DHS, you know, so there's this balance in this fund. It sounds like a lot of money in that balance, but they're a big organization, and a lot of the time we are, they, just like other agencies, are struggling to catch up with the technology. I mean, everybody knows that our challenge is getting everything to work smoothly the way it's supposed to. And it just seems to me that to have to do this, to take money out of that fund, potentially putting, you know, some of these things could actually end up costing more instead of saving money, as we've seen. If we don't do something right the first time, as we've heard with Minlars, then you have to lay off people, hire them back, try to find new people, and all of these things end up costing more money and making things even more difficult. So, you know, I it's sort of I appreciate Chair Dean's efforts on this, but I think that as a legislature, I hope we can do better than this. We've got a little more money. We obviously have to solve this problem of the 7%. We all want to do that, make sure that people get the services they absolutely need. And we did here in Representative Dean's committee, these are, you know, this is really serious for people if they don't get these services. I mean, this is really essential stuff. So something that we have to do, and, you know, I hope that the committee will take a closer look at this, and as we go forward here, that we can do better than what's in this amendment.
Other discussion of the A56 amendment? Chair Dean.
Mr. Chair and Representative Liebling, I appreciate that, and again, just trying to work back with MMB and DHS. It's very frustrating when we're dependent on CMS approval of these programs. It's not like we can operate without them. But again, we can't make assumptions very broadly beyond that, and MMB prudently says that we shouldn't and can't. And although we wanted to be able to spell out an end date directly in that, we were told that you can't do that until you get CMS approval. So we're reading this, I think, in a conservative way, and in a way that I'm comfortable with. I'm a little frustrated with the fiscal note and the inability to kind of nail that down. But I understand that the folks at DHS and MMB are doing the best they can with the approvals that they're trying to get, understanding that CMS just, you know, jerked all this money out of our forecast that we voted for, we were counting on, and now we don't have. So I guess I understand them wanting to be a little bit more conservative on that. And I want to turn a light on over there or something. It's like DHS is, there's like a dark spot in the.
Representative Murphy.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And Representative Dean, that dark spot might be that $8 million. I don't know. There you go. Yeah. I do think that, you know, we're in this place, and I know that the committee And you, Chair Dean, and the department and others are working to try and figure this out. But there was some warning signals at the end of last session about this that maybe we didn't heed, and we should have. But here we are, and we're trying to fix it because Minnesotans, you know, and people who are doing this work, caring for people with disabilities, are counting on finding a solution. I do want to say I think we should, and I will urge you to keep looking for an alternative funding source for this $8 million extra dollars that you need. When we listen to this legislature talking about the problems that we're having because we've underfunded or because we're having problems with technology, and when we take the money from here, we impact METS, and we impact our ability to draw down federal funds. We impact system modernization, and we're having problems with that, you know, in a variety of places in state government right now. So when we take the money, we make that harder for ourselves, and then when we make it harder for the departments, and then we, the legislature, when we get pushback from citizens, then we complain about it. So we might be creating our own problem by taking the money from there, so I hope you'll keep looking in other sources to find that money.
Other discussion to the A56 amendment? See no further discussion. All in favor of the A56 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The A56 amendment is adopted. All right. Let's next take up the A55 amendment. Representative Dean moves the A55 amendment. Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This is an amendment that we have with a piece of the bill dealing with prescribed pediatric extended care centers. And for members, what this, the easiest way to describe this is would be like a child care center for kids with very complex medical conditions that's trying to keep them out of the hospital and parents working and providing a place for kids with complex medical needs during the day. It's a new system, so we've been really trying to find our way with this. This is working with the Department of Health to alleviate some of the concerns that they had with the language within the bill and also Representative Loeffler's concerns around language directly looking at which kinds of kids would qualify. So it takes Representative Loeffler's concerns and incorporates those. This is an interesting idea. It's a new idea, so there was reasonably some issues around that. This tries to get at those that we weren't able to quite catch in the last fiscal committee, and appreciate your support on the A55.
Discussion of the A55 amendment. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And again, this is one of those items that everybody agrees on, or I think most of us agree that it's a good idea to do. But just one question about the amendment, Representative Dean, and I know something about Representative Loeffler's concerns and so on, but lines 3.24 to 3.27, which sets out some criteria to be an owner of a PPEC, I don't know if we're calling that PPEC or what we're exactly we're calling it, but anyway, what you have to do to be an owner. And I find that really curious because it doesn't require any kind of license for the, you know, it's, I just don't know where else in law we set out criteria for somebody to be an owner of a business like that. And could you just sort of explain why that language is going in there? Because, I mean, just for anyone listening, it says an owner has to have 2 years' experience in the past 5 years operating a business that provides care to medically complex or technologically dependent children or managing the care of medically complex or technologically dependent children. So you're not allowed to own one of these things unless you've either operated a business like this before or managed the care of these kids. That seems a little strange to me because we would think somebody could hire someone who has the technology, you know, the capability, and sort of, you know, the owner is just somebody whose money it is, I guess.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Representative Liebling, in the committee process, I think that there was some concern that, wow, these kids are on ventilators, they're really complicated, hard to manage. Are we going to have daycare centers that just try to go into this line of business that don't have any idea how to take care of these really, 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 really sick kids? And is that going to be a safe environment for kids? I know that was part of the discussion and within our committee, and that was a discussion point that was brought up. And this is addressing that, you know, you do have to have experience dealing with kids of high needs and complex needs medically to manage their care. And I think that's the genesis of that was the discussion within the Department of Health.
Okay. Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Any other discussion of the A55 amendment? Seeing no further discussion, all in favor of the A55 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The A55 amendment is adopted. Okay, members, there's another amendment being passed out, so at this time I'll take up the A59 amendment. And this is a technical amendment that was brought to me by Mr. Sullivan. It just clarifies that some appropriations are one-time appropriations. I'll move the A59 amendment. Is there any discussion of the A59 amendment? I see no discussion. All in favor of the A59 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The A59 amendment is adopted. Okay, members, I would ask you to disregard the A57 amendment that was passed out. The A60 amendment that you should have just received or are just receiving replaces the A57 amendment with a few technical changes that I believe were brought by Representative Hillstrom. I guess Representative Dean moves the A60 amendment, and Representative Dean, I'll let you speak to it, and then I'll recognize Representative Hillstrom. Or is this Representative Hillstrom's whole amendment? Yeah. Oh, it's Representative Hillstrom's whole amendment. I'm sorry. Representative Hillstrom moves the A60 amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Members, the Public Safety Committee heard the Vulnerable Adult Assault Bill today and actually made this amendment in committee. It was worked out between all parties. Representative Zerwas and I worked together, and this is the amendment that was actually adopted, and so it's appropriate to amend the bill here because this will be the bill that's moving forward, and I would ask members' support. One of the things we as the committee wanted to make sure is that as we enhance the penalties and make it easier to prosecute folks who abuse vulnerable adults, we want to make sure that people who are using restraint that complies with the law and are using some force as they do that restraint for the safety of the vulnerable adult. And we want to make sure that they're not charged with a crime. And one example that was given, for example, is if you have a vulnerable adult who has feces on them and maybe they're spreading it, you need to clean them up. You may need to physically restrain them. You may need to physically put them in a place where you can actually clean it up and clean them up and stop the incident from happening. We want to make sure that if you have to apply some force in that case, that you're not charged with a crime and seen that you are violating the statute. So it's a comfort language that we all agree gives the industry and the folks who actually provide this care some comfort to make certain that these difficult cases sometimes don't just result in folks getting kicked out of care facilities.
Representative Dean.
I appreciate Representative Hillstrom's work on this and urge members to support the amendment.
Okay. Any other discussion of the Hillstrom A60 amendment? I see no discussion. All in favor of the A60 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The A60 amendment is adopted. All right, members, I'm not aware of any other amendments other than House File 4160 that we'll later be amending. But I know that there are some individuals that wish to testify on the bill. Commissioner Malcolm, are you available? Commissioner Malcolm, I should probably say welcome back to the Ways and Means Committee. I'm sure you were here at some point in the past.
Yes, sir, I was. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Jan Malcolm, Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Health. Thank you so much for a few moments to speak to this important work that you're doing. Let me start by thanking Representative Dean and the entire Health and Human Services Committee for all the time that they've spent on the Supplemental Health and Human Services Budget Bill 3138. I want to say that it's clear that this bill does acknowledge the importance of some particularly timely and serious challenging issues facing our state, including, as Chair Dean has already mentioned, elder abuse and the opioid epidemic. With respect to almost every health challenge that we face, we strongly believe that focusing on prevention is the best long-term strategy for improving Minnesotans' health and quality of life, while at the same time sustainably managing health care costs for both public and private sector budgets at pretty much every level that you could name. And this bill does make some important investments in health. However, in some areas, the governor's budget recommended significantly more comprehensive approaches, which we think are merited given the seriousness of these issues. And some of his additional priorities that he recommended in his budget are not yet included in the bill, and I'd like to speak to a few of them. First, with respect to safe drinking water, the governor's budget recommended increasing safe drinking water fees by 28 cents per connection per month. The safe drinking water fee has not increased since 2005, and this small increase is essential for MDH to maintain the proactive efforts that we make with public water suppliers all across the state to ensure that Minnesotans enjoy safe drinking water. While we currently are able to provide these services to all public water supplies, the robust technical assistance that we're able to provide is especially valuable for smaller systems that lack their own resources and technical capacity, which often results in them having greater difficulty staying in compliance with standards. Without this overdue funding increase, we will have to reassess the services we're able to provide to public water suppliers and consider going to more of a reactive rather than a proactive model, which would mean waiting until a system is actually out of compliance with safe drinking water standards before we're able to step in. This is an issue of growing awareness and concern to local communities. We've heard from both public and private sectors, including our important rural hospitality industry. I urge the House to consider including this fee proposal in the supplemental bill. Next, on medical cannabis operations, the governor's budget included a realignment of medical cannabis program appropriations from the state government special revenue fund to spend the fees that are already coming in, that are already being paid by manufacturers and patients who've enrolled in this program. The realignment of the appropriations to make sure that the money that's being paid in is actually flowing to the program will allow for consistent funding for this robust and rapidly growing program, including maintenance of a very important 24/7 patient registry database, expert regulatory staff for working with the manufacturers, and staffing of an increasingly busy call center. It's important to note that this proposed budget adjustment does not change current law, does not raise fees, has no general fund impact or any added cost to Minnesota taxpayers. Rather, it would assure that the fees that are already being paid by the people using this program are available to support them at an appropriate level. Next, the important issue of elder abuse prevention. I very much appreciate the efforts by Representatives Keel and Zerwas to take steps to move forward on this issue. And while their efforts do pull in several of the recommendations made by the Office of the Legislative Auditor's report that I know you're aware of, the bill does not yet recognize the important fact that there's strong bipartisan support for more immediate actions to address the concerns brought forward by vulnerable adults and their families. In one respect, the bill currently lacks the common sense electronic monitoring protections that both the industry and the Senate have already agreed are needed, and it lacks any definitive promise to take action to fill critical gaps in our regulatory approach to assisted living settings or dementia care units. The language that was just added to the bill last week in the Health and Human Services Committee in the A48 amendment from Representative Zerwas is not currently reflected in your spreadsheet. Just today, I believe, we've completed a preliminary fiscal analysis of this language, indicating a cost to MDH of approximately $5 million per year. Next on the topic, before I leave this topic, as you know, the governor has strongly urged legislative leaders to swiftly enact this high-priority legislation on a standalone basis. I look forward to continuing to work with the House on this very important issue. On the issue of opioid abuse prevention, Governor Dayton proposed a package of proposals here that would annually invest about $12 million in high-impact strategies to treat and prevent opioid abuse, especially in communities disproportionately impacted by opioid addiction. Governor Dayton's opioid stewardship proposal would fund opioid abuse prevention and treatment strategies all across the state by requiring that opioid manufacturers pay a stewardship fee to fund a comprehensive effort in both treatment, prevention, and recovery efforts that would immediately begin to curb opioid abuse and save lives. I encourage you to consider including this fair funding stream as you consider Representative Baker's House File 1440. On this issue as well, the governor has urged swift action to send him a standalone bill so that we can get to work right now deploying critically needed resources to address this threat. Finally, I'd like to draw your attention to an urgent general fund request that's included actually in the governor's bonding bill, but I'd like to make you aware of it. A request for $2.37 million in one-time resources to replace outdated equipment in our public health laboratory, which truly is one of the finest in the nation. Specific and expensive new high-technology equipment is needed in the lab to keep pace with ever-emerging science and to provide time-critical and highly accurate tests for a wide range of health threats, from foodborne illness to emerging as well as familiar infectious disease agents, environmental risks such as PFCs in water, radiation, and the unfortunately real risks of biological or chemical terrorism. We would appreciate your consideration as the process moves forward for that urgent request. In closing, Mr. Chair and members, we're all rightly proud, I think, and working hard to keep Minnesota's status as overall a very healthy state. But we know we face some significant challenges in closing the gaps we know exist for many communities and in maintaining that overall status. Governor Dayton's budget has attempted to respond to these challenges in a strategic way to benefit the health of Minnesotans right now and into the future. I look forward to working with the House and the Senate on these critical issues to produce a budget that can make some common sense reforms and smart public health investments to protect and enhance the quality of life for all of our citizens. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Commissioner. I believe we have a few questions. Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You brought up the 28-cent fee increase that hasn't been included in this bill. And I was just wondering if this pot of money that you want to increase is used for source water protection plans and implementation for municipal wells and for communities that don't now have source water protection plans.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Wagenius, I have to apologize that I'm not as familiar yet with which water supplies are included in this fee proposal. I believe that the answer to that is yes, but I would ask any of my staff who are here to quickly correct me if I'm not correct about that. And we can certainly get back to you with a definitive answer.
Well, I think it would be
Representative.
Important, thank you, for us to understand because I know many municipal wells have source water protection plans, but many, many, and I think it's in the hundreds, do not. And that's basic to protecting drinking water. And so it would be helpful to understand what's going on there.
Thank you. I will get back to you on that.
Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sometimes the numbers seem so daunting in these budget discussions, but I'm struck in the letter from Ms. Malcolm that's in our packets. She points out correctly, I think, prevention is cheaper than treatment and reminds us that the safe drinking water fee has not been increased since 2005 and that the request is a 28 cents per connection per month increase. 28 cents per connection per month for safe drinking water. That's not such a daunting number, and so it is surprising that we somehow didn't figure out how to do that in this bill. Thank you for bringing this.
Any other questions? If not, thank you for your testimony, Commissioner.
Thank you.
And I believe we have one other testifier, Acting Commissioner Johnson. Welcome back, Acting Commissioner. Could you please identify yourself again for the record?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chuck Johnson. I'm Acting Commissioner at the Minnesota Department of Human Services. Thank you for the opportunity to come back and address the bill, and thank you to Representative Dean and the Health and Human Services Committee for the time that you put in to put this bill together. There are many positive aspects of the bill that I'd like to talk about, as well as some concerns that we have with some of the provisions of the bill. As Commissioner Malcolm said, pleased to see that we're working together on trying to address the elder abuse issue as well as the opioid crisis. Those are both issues where I think there's a lot of common ground in terms of moving us toward some solutions that we can agree on. From the Department of Human Services perspective within the elder abuse, there are several priorities we have from a funding perspective that we think are really critical items to ensuring that we're really addressing this problem and really putting some resources in the hands of seniors and their families across Minnesota, including funding of staff for the Ombudsman for Long-Term Care, as well as funding for the Minnesota Adult Abuse Reporting Center, the MARC Center, which we'll need to expand in order to really incorporate as a single stop for all reports for adult abuse, including those in the MDH, Department of Health regulated areas, as well as some money to help us better coordinate reporting with law enforcement, and funding to help counties manage their end of this business. We talk a lot about what we're doing, what the Department of Health is doing, but counties also do a lot of investigation of vulnerable adults, and they need to have the resources to be effective at that as well. Within the opioid crisis area, we're pleased that the committee did include a project that would help us use essentially general practitioners and family doctors to make it a little bit easier to get some folks into treatment more quickly, and we think that's a positive move forward. The governor put forward a comprehensive package that included prevention, treatment, and law enforcement investments. We hope that the package we get out of session also includes that kind of a balanced approach. As Commissioner Malcolm said, both of those issues are issues where the governor would like to have standalone bills that move separately, so we're able to address them in a fashion that represents the shared concern that we all have. The other major issue or major initiative of the governor's that was not included in the bill is the Minnesota Care Buy-In proposal. We're concerned that's not included. Believe that given where we're looking toward 2020 with the reinsurance money running out, that we're going to have an issue we need to address in the individual market. We put this proposal forward. We think it's a common sense way to address that crisis, but we also understand that it's not necessarily the only way. We just wanted to have an option out on the table for people to consider, provide better access to care at a cheaper cost than we're looking at the individual market right now. Related to this is also the repeal of the provider tax that the governor proposed to repeal the sunset. Again, when you all come into session next year, you'll be looking at a much different forecast horizon without the provider tax in place, and there'll be a lot of challenges from the perspective of trying to manage going forward with the costs of health care in our state. We believe that now is the time to take action on that as well. Several items that we're really pleased that the House is including in its bill, the governor's initiative around program integrity for non-emergency medical transportation. This is an area where we've had some issues, provide some more audit oversight of those programs. We think that's appropriate, as well as the work with the funding of the Consolidated Chemical Dependency Treatment Fund, which is really a fiscal effort to make more transparency in how those dollars are used. Also, I want to mention it's not in this bill, it's actually in the education bill, but the inclusion by the House of the school-linked mental health grants. That's another critical priority. It's been a really popular initiative both on the mental health side of the world and within education. We did include some staff with that proposal that are not included in the House bill. We think that's really critical to have those staff included. We have one person who will be essentially operating a $16 million grant program going forward if these funds are provided. We're also pleased that the proposal in front of you has some work to help us address our federal compliance within the Child Care Assistance Program, leveraging some federal money that's available to help us do that work together, and we've worked with Representative Dean and others to bring this together. There's a couple of pieces the House bill does not address that we're concerned about. One is the health and safety for the legal non-licensed provider. It's a federal requirement. We think it's
critical to ensure that kids who are in legal non-licensed care are getting adequate care, as well as tying the child care assistance program rates to the current market survey. So we're in compliance with the federal government and keeping up with the most recent rate survey. A few other items that were not in the governor's budget but are in this bill that I want to mention briefly as well. The inclusion of the electronic visit verification system. This is an important item. It's also federal compliance, creates some savings. This really creates some program integrity within some of our home-based services. Our letter to the committee accidentally left out the paragraph on the disability waiver rate system, which you spent some time talking about earlier, that the governor does not have a position on DWRS, but we have been working with legislators, with the advocates, with the provider groups to put together solutions that really, from our perspective, what we can do is help try to put us in a position to get something that CMS will approve, which is obviously the concern after what happened last year. As well as see a positive investment in the workforce for these critical services. We're also pleased the bill includes a small amount of money for the child residential facilities, plugging a gap that was created at the end of last session, and we think that's important that that gets taken care of as well. We're disappointed the bill didn't include the rate increase the governor proposed for personal care attendants. We have all heard about the workforce crisis for people with disabilities, the inability sometimes to get to work, to be able to get out of bed in the morning, to take care of themselves. This is a relatively modest rate increase, but we think it's important to keep up with the needs of people who depend on PCAs. Also, the child support fee item, the federal government has raised the fee for child support. That was not included in the bill. We think if the legislature takes no action there, that is actually ends up being a cost to the counties on how it plays out. And then finally, there are a number of items in the bill that we have concerns about and are problematic for us going forward that were also not a governor's initiatives. As we discussed a little bit earlier, in addition to the $8 million that was removed by Amendment A 56, there's also in this bill repurposing of $14 million in additional funds from the DHS system fund. These are funds that we had dedicated to our direct care and treatment area toward patient and staff safety initiatives as well as development of electronic health record for that part of our department. We're concerned that these dollars are being removed and taken for other purposes as well. And that's in addition to the $8 million we talked about earlier. The bill also would have any spending in IT that we do out of any year-end spending have to be approved by the LAC. And that would put us under some additional scrutiny by the legislature. We believe that that really interferes with our ability to manage those resources effectively for the purposes that we think are important for the agency. Within the prescribed pediatric extended care center, which I now lost what the acronym was for it, that we talked about earlier, we have a concern around the rate for those providers that's in the bill. Similar to DWRS, CMS will hold us to having a rate that we can base on showing what the costs are. And so we need a cost-based rate of some sort, and there's a rate that's in the bill right now that we don't think would meet that test with CMS. We're willing to keep working on that. We just need to get it to a point where we think we can have a workable rate going forward. The bill includes some provisions around Minnesota Care premium reconciliation. We had a conversation about this in Representative Dean's committee a couple of weeks ago. We don't believe that we're in a position to reconcile those premiums and collect back the uncollected premiums. We believe the best move at this point going forward is to not have families have to go through that process again, not spend another hundreds or thousands of hours of our staff working on it when we can't really come to a proper reconciliation needed for those premiums. We don't believe it's effective to have that provision in this bill. There's a couple of other provisions that address eligibility. One that's related to verification, a 2% withhold on a payment to managed care organization. If they don't have a verification in a given month from an individual that they are really still receiving the program, receiving those services. This was a bill that was proposed last session, too. We opposed it last session. We don't think it's workable under federal law. Essentially creates another eligibility rule beyond what already exists in law for individuals. We believe it would be very hard to administer, particularly probably for the managed care organizations. There's also a proposal in this bill, which we have had in the bill before, that DHS would be required to hire a vendor to do checks on eligibility for individuals. We don't really know how this would work. There's no mechanism in the bill to actually compensate the vendor for the work that they're doing. It seems to duplicative of a number of projects or programs we already have in place to check against existing data to determine whether or not people remain eligible for the programs that they're in, and would also get in the way of our continued work to do IT upgrades to our systems, which will already be challenging if the $22 million of IT funding that this bill takes out is lost through the legislative process. We oppose the requirement that we get approval from the legislature before we move toward a preferred drug list. This is an issue we've been looking at to try to control pharmacy expenditures within our programs. We put out a request for comment late last year around our next generation integrated health plans and got a lot of positive feedback on the idea of having a preferred drug list across our programs. And we believe that by not having that tool, we will actually see our pharmacy trend go up faster than we want it to, as well as just reducing our ability to innovate within our programs going forward. And then finally, there's a few other dedicated funds that are addressed to take the total of $4.4 million taken out of our budget, which again would reduce our ability to be able to deliver services properly. I think at this point, you know, some of the concerns really are in the healthcare area and ensuring that we have the ability to be able to manage and manage our costs and innovate within those programs, and concern that some of the provisions in this bill would make it very difficult for us to do that going forward. So thank you for taking the time to listen to me today, consideration of these comments. I appreciate the work. We'll continue to work with you going forward and hope to get a good Health and Human Services bill at the end of session. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner Johnson. Any questions for Commissioner Johnson? All right. Thank you, Commissioner. I am not aware of any other people that wanted to testify on the bill. So I think at this point, before we go into the final discussion of the bill, it would be a good time to go back to bringing forward House File 4160 as amended. So I'm going to take up House File 4160 as amended, the transportation bill, and move that House File 4160 as amended be amended on to House File 3138, and that staff make any technical corrections necessary to reflect the will of the committee. Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just briefly, I know there's been a lot of discussion about, well, transportation and health and how do they relate. And, you know, I have a document that I'm not going to, I'll just share it with you, Mr. Chair, not the committee, but from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, and talks about transportation and health and they're the nexus between them. And they say, we know the transportation choices we make play an important role in building and maintaining healthy communities. They talk about physical activity, injury prevention, air pollution associated with respiratory and heart diseases, social capital and mental health, environmental justice and social equity. So I think, Mr. Shea, you're on point. And so if people push back on this, I'd like to just pass the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention to you. And I think, you know, you're in the ballpark here with this.
Well, thank you for that, Representative Hornstein. And if I do get pushback, I'll give them your phone number. Any other discussion to the motion? And I do appreciate that. Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And just along the same lines, I mean, those of us who work on health and human services like to say, as Commissioner Ellinger used to say, you know, health in all policies. So I appreciate that, Representative Hornstein. But I also wanted to suggest that the transportation bill, you know, what rather than that one being the vehicle, since the HHS bill is a vehicle, that maybe we could think of it as an ambulance that may be needed by the transportation bill.
Any other discussion? All right, I'll renew my motion that House File 4160 as amended be amended on to House File 3138, and that staff be instructed to make any technical corrections necessary to reflect the will of the committee. All in favor of that motion, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. House File 4160, as amended, is amended onto House File 3138. All right, now we have House File 3138 as amended with the transportation bill within it before the committee. Further discussion on the health and human service components of the bill. Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, just I don't want to talk a lot. I mean, it is a very large bill, and it has a lot of things in it. A lot of them are good things, and it does try to deal with the 7% problem, which is a real problem. As we just heard from the commissioner, it does not try to deal with the problem of increasing rates for personal care attendance. That's a significant oversight. But the real, you know, it is a bill that misses some opportunities, but more importantly, I think it has some real poison pills in it. And one of the biggest shortcomings, I think, is that if people look to a health and human services bill to help provide health care and expand health care for people in the state who need it, this bill really falls short. And the way it does that in particular is that it not only doesn't include the Minnesota Care buy-in, which is a way that a lot of people around the state, especially in rural parts of the state, might be able to find affordable health insurance, which they cannot find now. But it actually stops that from going forward. This is a poison pill in the bill. The commissioner talked a little bit about the premium reconciliation, and the bottom line is that it tells DHS to do what it can't do and says if you can't do this, then you can't move forward with Minnesota Care. So it essentially stops Minnesota Care. There's also language in the bill that once again goes after MnSure, the and I know these are terms that are confusing for the public, and I always get emails and see people still confusing the two things. Everything's Min this and Min that, right? But, you know, MnSure is a platform, an organization where people can go to get health insurance, whether public or private. Again, this bill goes after MnSure. It's the old kill MnSure stuff again, and then prevents the administration from moving forward with a program that would help people get health insurance who don't have it. So I appreciate that this bill does a lot of good things. I appreciate that the funding in the bill is, not fake funding. That's good to see that the numbers seem to be, you know, pretty solid, and that Representative Dean has made some real efforts to deal with some real knotty issues. There are these poison pills, and I don't think this is not a game to Minnesotans who watch us here and are struggling with how they're going to have access to health care. This legislature spent $800 million trying to bring down the cost of health insurance for people who are paying full freight. It was not very successful, and yet in this bill we have items that are really attacking the systems that we have. And I think that if the Republican majority does not have real ideas about how to move forward and get people access to health insurance affordably, that at least it shouldn't stand in the way of other people's ideas for doing that. So that's my major comment on this bill, Mr. Chair. And so I certainly, at this point, am not able to support it, although it does have in it, as I said, a lot of things that we do agree on. We've had very good discussions in the Health and Human Services Committee. I think, as I said in that committee, Chair Dean was very fair in terms of the discussion and, you know, I think really did try to balance some difficult things, but I hope that at the end of the day we will have a better bill than this one. Thank you.
I have Representative Davids, then Erdahl. Representative Davids.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and we're kind of like rewriting history here. To say that the actions we took last year were not very successful, well, the truth is exactly contrary to what the one member said, because it stopped a lot of the bleeding, it leveled off rates, and we're trying to work on fixing a system that Obamacare destroyed. Chair Dean, thank you so very much for not including the MinCare buy-in. I really appreciate that. What that does is it reimburses, to get these lower rates, it reimburses hospitals and doctors at a very low rate. And I've had many come to me saying that if the MinCare buy-in goes forward, they are out of business. So thank you, Chair Dean, for saving my rural hospitals and my rural clinics. I do appreciate that. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I was just wondering, Representative Liebling, do you consider $800 million to be a big number?
Representative Liebling, I guess you've been asked to yield. Go ahead, Representative Liebling.
Well, Representative Erdahl, I think that this is probably a loaded question. I guess it just it depends on what we're talking about spending it on.
All right. Representative Erdahl?
Be nice.
Nah. All right. Sounds big to me. Other discussion? Representative Dean.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and to Commissioner Johnson and all of DHS, thanks to all the staff who works very, very hard working with our members and both majority and minority parties to put this bill together to try to do a lot of good things. Also, especially want to thank Commissioner Malcolm for a very, very tough job jumping in to a very difficult situation and just doing a great job working with our committee and testifying and making folks available. Really do appreciate you and your willingness to work together. So thank you very, very much for all of your work to help the department, but also to help the legislature in putting this together. This does address our three major issues of the opioid abuse epidemic and crisis in the state of Minnesota, the salaries for low-income folks who provide care to people in the community, which is a top priority for us, also the elder abuse issue, along with some other really good things within a $10 million target. True, we don't reinstate the provider tax as a fiscal portion of this bill. That's one that I don't think we should do. Minnesota Care, which is the 2% provider sick tax, which was initiated for that, no longer really funds that. That's funded within the Medicaid expansion. So we can and should sunset the provider tax moving forward, and we don't need to do that in order to keep the care that we currently have. So I hope we don't do that moving ahead. And with the governor's initiatives, we also want to thank the chair for giving us a hard target on the Health Care Access Fund, which that money provides $700 million to and has accrued and has been misused many times in the past. That's what I refer to as the banana stand, which there's always money in the banana stand, as we know, so that's been raided very many times. So we appreciate the zero target and hard target on the banana stand. Also on the premium reduction account, or as I refer to as the cookie jar, and the other cookie jar is the reinsurance money. So those, we had zero and hard targets on all three, which I appreciate, Representative Chairman Knobloch, because we're going to have to watch those going into the conference committee. I will continue to watch those, and I know you will as well. We were able to make our $10 million target and provide a lot of good things and also pull some money out of the system. So I appreciate your support and appreciate any help moving forward as this bill goes to the floor.
All right. I'm sorry, Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm just wondering if you had a tails target for this piece of for this bill.
Well, we did have a tails target for this bill. I believe it was $55 million.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And as I understand it, Representative Dean, did we make that target as well?
We
Representative
did.
Dean.
So $10 million now and $55 million in the tails.
Representative Murphy, yes, that is what the target was.
Thank you.
Representative Dean, did you have any other comments? I know those were your closing statements.
Oh, I appreciate the clarification, Representative Murphy.
Okay. With that, Chair Dean renews his motion that House File 3138, as amended, be referred to the General Register and that staff make any technical corrections necessary to reflect the will of the committee. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. House File 3138, as amended, is referred to the General Register. And members, we will see you after session tomorrow. Wait for the announcement on the floor. Remember also there will be a meeting at 10 a.m. Friday morning. With that, we are adjourned.